Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1, action.
Assume nothing.
Rash, bald-faced blasphemy.
Question everything.
I find it extremely hard to imagine.
Open your eyes.
It is quite all right to be an atheist.
The fastest growing group of people in the country has been measured as being those who have no belief or who are atheists.
You don't have to be apologetic or quiet about it.
Challenge the opposition.
You see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument.
And start thinking. This is The Thinking Atheist Worldwide.
Looks like I'm going to Wichita, Kansas. Going to take a presentation up there. We're just going to hang out together at Wichita Oasis on March the 5th. I'm looking forward to that. You know, Oasis has been a big Sunday assembly kind of thing that is really taking off. It's a nice way for secular people who don't want woo in their community to be able to still have community. And I know there's some naysayers that were like, oh my God, it's just atheist church. But I totally disagree. I think we are community people. We are communal creatures. We like to get together and share common interests and be together. And it's nice to do that without all the bullshit from the podium about God and devils and angels and demons and magic. And, you know, it's more about making the world a better place, making friends, having community. I support that. I think it's a great idea. I'm going to be at Wichita Oasis March the 5th. If you want to go, it's totally free. You can go to wichitaoasis.org. and see all the details. Looks like I'm going to be in New Orleans and then Jackson, Mississippi in May. And they just confirmed the Canada, the Toronto event, Imagine No Religion 7. So I'm going to be out there, Richard Dawkins, Lawrence Krauss. So I just want to throw that out here at the top of the broadcast. If you want to find out about any of these events, you can go to thethinkingatheist.com/events. Speaking of Canada, I'm browsing Netflix the other day. And I stumble across a show called Canada's Worst Drivers. Now, it's not a hugely well-produced show. It's not like Top Gear. It's not next-level production. It's just kind of a pedestrian show where apparently people throughout Canada have nominated the worst drivers that they know. And you and I have known some bad drivers in our lives. We probably still do. Right? Don't ever ride with them. Always offer to drive. Take a cab. Call Uber. Do something else. Don't ride with them. Well, these people are a whole nother level of bad driver, and they're nominated by spouses and friends and neighbors and whatnot, and they end up on this TV show, and oh my God, it's terrifying. They put them through these paces, all of these different courses. They set up scenarios. They're having to parallel park a school bus or a limousine, or they're driving through cones, or they have to drive on ice, or they put up these big concrete pillars where the wheels barely fit on the edges, and they have to drive across the pillars to know where their wheels are. I mean, all kinds of scenarios, and it is maddening. And it's terrifying how spatially unaware many people who have a legal driver's license, how spatially unaware they are. You've heard somebody say it's fascinating like a car wreck. This show is fascinating like a car wreck, literally. And I can't stop watching it. I think they have season 7 and 8 or whatever. We watched season 7 in a weekend, and I'm into season 8. And I'm just thinking, this is insane. These people are out there. They're out there. I've also learned that in Canada, it's not car. You don't drive a car. You drive a car. The car. You go far in the car, okay? That's what I'm learning anyway. So, but I digress. Anyway, Imagine No Religion is in Toronto. Hopefully, I won't bump into any of the drivers from the show while I'm up there. All right. What else is going on real fast? Next week is a full-on whole show dedicated to a conversation with the son of a famous American evangelist named Tony Campolo. His son is Bart Campolo, who recently, just a few years ago, announced he no longer believed in the Bible and Jesus and Yahweh, and he rejected Christianity outright. But he's still a minister, okay? Well, I had the chance to have a conversation with Bart Campolo on the radio. And I was going to make it part of this show because it sort of ties into religious families, right? His dad's a famous evangelist. But upon reflection, I decided that I really wanted to take more time with Bart and to spend more time speaking with him about his story. I mean, It's pretty intense, you know, 30 years in the faith. You're probably touring with Dad. He's written dozens of books and he's been featured on major television shows and he's consulted presidents. And now his son is an atheist. You know, that's a big deal. That's a compelling and fascinating story. We're going to talk to Bart Campolo next Tuesday. We're going to hear his story. And then 2 weeks from today will be the occasion of the United States President's State of the Union Address. It's an annual speech given by the Commander-in-Chief. I'm going to bring on some experts in government and the Constitution and a scientist, and we're going to talk a little bit about the State of the Union. But then the whole last half of the show is going to be a secular State of the Union address delivered by me. Essentially, an alternative State of the Union address presented by an atheist, a skeptic, a humanist, and just an every person, a citizen of the United States. A secular State of the Union address will happen 2 weeks from tonight. Now, today's show is about religious families and their often conditional love. You say you're a non-believer, and all of a sudden the temperature of the relationship really starts to change, and they treat you differently, and they speak to you and about you differently, and things become often much harder, and we're going to hear from people who are navigating that in their own lives. I'm also going to take some time and talk to Patricia Guzikowski. She's a national certified counselor and aligned with SecularTherapy.org. And she deals with people who are going through these really dark times. You know, they're feeling isolated, cut off, depressed, tense, sad, angry, pissed off, you know. She's going to speak about and to the people who are navigating these difficult waters in their own lives, and we're going to get her perspective later on in the broadcast. First, I want to say a huge thanks out to our show sponsor for today. You know, of the many shows we do, so many broadcasts tie into the need for critical thinking. We talk about it all the time. Critical thinking has never been more critical, which is why I want you to check out the Great Courses Plus lecture series by Dr. Stephen Novella. He's a neurologist and professor at Yale. The series is called Your Deceptive Mind, a scientific guide to critical thinking skills. Fascinating science about belief versus reality. Logical fallacies, bias in the brain, how we get scammed when we're tricked into belief, mass delusion in anti-science cultures. Relevant stuff, really. And this series is among over 8,000 courses in the Great Courses Plus online library, streaming right to your computer, TV, laptop, or smartphone. Learn more about how to think critically. Learn more, period. Get your first month free when you sign up at thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. Sign up today, thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. Here is an email from Andrea. She said, I'm from Mexico. I've been listening to your podcast for several months. I'm an atheist for almost a year, and I cannot explain how much my life has changed. I'm 18. I was a Christian for 17 years of my life. I was one of the leaders of the youth group for almost 4 years. We organized crazy events and people accepted Jesus in their hearts, and I rejoiced in his eternal love. I'm an atheist and no one knows it, except my boyfriend that came to the same conclusion a couple months before me. We've been each other's support through all of this path. I can't tell my mom I'm an atheist because I'm afraid she would stop paying for my university and other things. I'm a medical student, and I just started last year. She literally told me, you will attend church for as long as you live under my roof. I've told her several times, with tears in my eyes, that I can't keep going to church because it makes me really unhappy. The reason she thinks I don't want to go anymore is because I had a lot of issues with the pastor and other adults. My church is Methodist, and every decision is based on a very squared mindset. I take advantage of that situation to make her think I'm hurt, but really, I'm angry. Angry because religion took away a lot of my time and energy because I did horrible things to others, going straight to people, saying they were going to hell, and condemning every person around me, hoping they would understand the beauty of being a soldier of God. I'm angry because every year Christians scared children at Vacation Bible School, telling them that if they don't offer their heart to Jesus, they'll go to eternal damnation along with their family. And, well, I was a big part of it. You know, I was that girl who stood in front of all these kids and forced them to praise the Lord, to sing songs, even to dance. I was the girl that would go to hospitals and pray for the sick and give them false hope. I was the girl that organized huge events and planned every part of the night so that in the end everyone would end up crying on the floor praising God. I was such a happy person. I won't deny that. I really thought I was doing the right thing. I was going to be part of a generation that would change the world. And you know, I wasn't wrong, because I'm now part of the generation that will actually change the world. Because I will defend reason, logic, and education as the first tool to achieve peace in this world. Sadly, that will have to wait, because right now, I'm in the middle of this Christian family who's just like I used to be. And here in Mexico, when you say family, you really mean family. You know, everyone. All of my aunts, great-aunts, cousins, grandparents, were all very close. If there was any kind of suspicion that I don't believe in God, they would stop talking to me. I'm having a really hard time. I feel like I can't breathe. I know what you're thinking. She's 18. She can leave her house. Well, Mexican culture is very different from the U.S. Here, single people don't leave out of the bloom. You leave your parents' house on your wedding day. Living alone as a teenager is unacceptable to society, just like living with a partner without being married. Seth, you and all of the atheist community are out there. You can live your life to the fullest and enjoy the freedom that you have. Scream to the world your opinion, reason, and logic, and try to impact the world while I'm here waiting to join you. Thanks for all your work. I really appreciate your show and the platform that you give to openly talk about the difficulties of people like me. Hopefully one day I can thank you, Dan Barker, and Richard Dawkins in person for the big change you've made in my life. Much love, Andrea. You know, it's interesting, Andrea. The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins and Dan Barker's book Godless, along with Charles Templeton's book Farewell to God. Templeton was a former Canadian evangelist. Those three books were part of my ticket out. You know, it's like you discover the world in many ways for the first time. I mean, you emerge from the fog and you look around and you say, I had no idea this whole rest of the world was even here. I had no idea that these ideas existed. I had no idea these facts existed. Where have I been? Actually, my first thought was, where have they been? Who is this Dawkins character? Have they been hiding him under a rock? And of course, the obvious occurs to me. It wasn't him that was under a rock. It was me. I had been living in this cocoon. I'd been living in this reinforcement culture. And you know, when I emerged, I probably felt much of what you're feeling now. Trapped in a culture that seemed eager, not just to misunderstand, but eager not to listen. And they put their fingers in their ears and they just didn't care. Of course, I'm pounding the drum and sounding the alarm in my own life. I'm 37, 38 years old, saying, if you guys only knew, if you guys only knew what was in the Bible, you'd reject this stuff immediately. I mean, it's crazy. Let me show you these data points. And they look at me and they just glaze over and their eyes go glassy and they smile that sort of pity-filled, condescending smile and say, oh, bless your heart. I'm so sorry that you don't feel the love of Jesus in your life right now. Oh, it just makes me crazy. Yes, but look at this list perfectly organized, and I've got it here, and it's charted out, and it's color-coded, and here's embedded experts in the field, and then they've been peer-reviewed by other scientists, and let's take a look at the historicity of Jesus, blah, blah, blah. Oh, Seth, I'm so sorry that you just don't know the love of God right now. You know, Satan whispers in our ears at times, and it's just something we have to fight against. And I know one day you will come to know his love again. And the more I heard that, the more I felt my blood start to boil, and I became angry, probably a lot like you, right? Nobody cares. Nobody seems interested in the facts. They're more interested in belief than knowledge. Andrea, just remember, you're not alone. I understand the feeling of isolation you have where you are. But the non-religious, the people who are walking away from all this nonsense, those numbers are growing every single day. And whether or not you're speaking out loud or not, you're part of it. Okay, you're part of it. And your mind, belongs to you and your life belongs to you and your voice belongs to you. And even though you have to, at this measure, play a long game until you can find that platform where you can stand on your own, you know, you get through university and you get to a point of independence personally and financially. Until you get there, I understand playing the long game, playing it close to the chest, keeping the peace. I understand it. I totally do. There will come a day when you can speak out loud in your voice at the volume you choose for your reasons on your terms. I know that day is coming. It may not be tomorrow. It may not be 2 years from tomorrow, but I know it's coming. So you hang in there, engage with communities online, you know, where it's safer, where people can be there for you and engage you and sort of help to scratch the community itch until you can come to that point in your own life and just stay the course, you know. Ultimately, at the end of the day, we just want to know whatever's true. A truthful life is what I wish for you, Andrea. And thanks so much for the message and for the kind words. It really means a lot. I've got area code 309. You were on the Thinking Atheist radio podcast. Tell me your name.
Ken.
Ken, what's going on? We're talking about religious families' conditional love. You have a story for us?
Yes. My wife and I are both atheists, and her son and his wife are fundamentalist Baptists. And they invited us a few weeks ago to go to our 8-year-old grandson's baptism. And we agonized over this for about an hour and realized we didn't want to upset them because they all already shun my biological granddaughter because she's being raised in an atheist household. So we don't want access to our other grandkids to be cut off. So we decided to go.
You're grieved about the idea that this young child's being indoctrinated in this sort of baptism ceremony, right? You have to sit there and watch as a spectator. It's got to be painful.
It is. They're homeschooled. They were homeschooled for several years. And I've seen some of their textbooks, and it's just indoctrination completely. And so, yeah, I grew up in a fundamentalist Christian church in Kentucky. And so the service, when we went, you know, they didn't tell us we would have to sit through the whole service. And that was the worst part of it all. But it was fascinating to hear the service. I could have written it. I could have organized it, outlined it from my childhood. And the sermon, too. And it really was eye-opening after being away from it for so long.
And all around you, people are nodding and smiling and amening, right?
Oh, yes. Hallelujah and praise Jesus. But we sat in the back row on the two aisle seats because I thought, if this building is going to crumble in, I'm getting the hell out of here.
That's a rationalist for you right there. Always have your escape route handy. You know, always take the matter into your own hands. I respect that, Kent. I'm sorry. Go ahead. So you guys are perched on the back row. And how old is your grandson?
8 years old.
Okay. Take me from there.
Well, this service and the sermon especially, I've talked to some Christians in the last few years as I've become more activist, thanks largely in part to your podcast.
Thank you.
But I've talked to people who have started backpedaling from the torture forever philosophy and saying that hell is actually a separation from God. Well, not in this church. This pastor was saying being good isn't good enough. It's not about good works. It's about the salvation and accepting Jesus and talk of flames of hell licking at your feet. And that was an exact quote. What made me the angriest was he told the story about his grandmother who had never been a believer. And she always acted negatively and forcefully when he tried to give her his testimony. So finally, she's on her deathbed, and you know the cliche. She could barely speak. She didn't have long to live. So he gave her his testimony again, and in a very feeble voice, she said she would accept Jesus. And everybody's nodding their head, and I was seething with anger. I felt that what she was doing was being the better person, and in her final moments, giving him what he needed. Instead of him having the decency to give her love in her final moments, instead of once again harassing her with his testimony. After the service, I felt emotionally assaulted because it's been so long since I've sat through one of those. Wasn't he the role model to convert a dying atheist on her deathbed?
That's an interesting perspective I hadn't considered. What if in her final moments, her act of love was to simply give him words of comfort, knowing that he would be able to carry those through the rest of his life? For her, it was an act of giving to him. That's interesting.
When my father was dying, my mother, who had treated him pretty terribly in his life, visited him when he was on his deathbed. And he was the bigger person. He let her get it off her chest and gave her that kindness that he wasn't going to die being angry at her. So I think people do that sometimes.
When you look at your grandchild, I mean, you must have the hope that at one point the child will be able to know his own mind, right? To take his own journey. Certainly these thoughts are going through your skull, right?
Well, I was baptized when I was about 10, and I only did it so that I could get the crackers and the grape juice and the communion every week like my other friends.
Yeah.
But later, as an adult, I realized it's just indoctrination, and no one should be baptized until they hit the age of reason and are old enough to understand what they really believe. He doesn't act very. He's 8 years old. He's an 8-year-old boy, hyperactive. He's doing what his parents want.
Did you pay a price in your own life for being, I don't know how open or how activist you are? You said you're more of an activist these days, but I mean, is there a penalty in place? Have you felt a portion of their hearts and their lives sort of cordoned off from you because you're not like them?
Oh, yeah. A few years ago, 3 years ago, my sister showed up at my best friend's mother's funeral. And in the parking lot, she gave me hell for being an atheist. And when I didn't like that, she punished me by not inviting my wife and I to my nephew's wedding the next year. So I haven't seen her since.
She just cut you off.
Yeah. And I've had other relatives do that. And word has come around to me that they think I'm going to be in hell forever. And of course, they feel sorry for me.
Interesting that she used the occasion of a funeral as her soapbox for a religious belief. I mean, what a horribly inopportune moment to have that conversation in the first place, I think.
Yeah, she didn't even know the woman. She just showed up there to give me hell.
Oh, she knew you were coming?
Yeah. I don't take it anymore. I consider it a civil rights issue. If you're going to dislike me or treat me badly because of my religious views, well, she wouldn't have tolerated that. But this is the fundamentalist mindset. They can't even accept. They recoil, as you know, when someone questions their faith.
May I ask just quickly, what was your ticket out? How in the world did you get from, hey, I was baptized at 10 and kind of a reflection of my parents' belief to where you are today? What happened to you?
Well, I was in a Sunday school class in the mid to late 60s, and we had a guest speaker come in who put up some charts to show us how the Beatles and the Rolling Stones were worshiping Satan in their lyrics. And maybe the other kids there liked it, but it pissed me off.
You don't insult the Beatles and the Stones. You just
don't do
that.
Oh, man. And I thought, if they're lying about this, what else are they lying about?
You're a smarter kid than I was, brother. I went to a ton of those classes. They played the records forwards and backwards. You know, there was the devil was oozing out of those things. All the bands were of the devil.
And Painted Black, the song Painted Black was that's Satan's color. That's what they're doing. And I thought, man, it's about a depressed guy who lost his girlfriend.
So that's planted the seed of skepticism, right? Before you know it, you're like, hey, wait a minute. Something's wrong here. And before you knew it, you realized that all of it was just a bunch of crap, huh?
And when the Kung Fu TV show came out, being raised in Kentucky, and seeing the philosophy that those monks had, and there was no Jesus involved, and it really started me thinking and studying and looking into other things. because you never hear that stuff when you're being raised in the 50s and 60s in Kentucky. So that was a big, that was an eye-opening development.
Ken, I got to go back and watch some old Kung Fu now. I got to go back and pull up some old David Carradine and see what they were talking about back then. I don't remember much. I think I was, I mean, I was born in 68, so I'm doing the math. How old was I?
Well, they would have fight scenes, of course, but they would have flashbacks where the monks would be giving him lessons, and they were Taoist Zen type lessons, and it was so peaceful and wonderful, and I would think, what a great way to look at the world without all the punishment, and you have to do this or you're going to be tortured forever. My God, it's just an ugly philosophy. And going to my grandson's baptism just drove it home again.
Well, it's my hope, I'm sure it's yours as well, one day that he'll come to a point where you and I came in our own lives, when we start to look around with clearer eyes and we're encouraged to be ourselves.
I want to be a role model, but it's very difficult. I want to, I've got an older granddaughter who's just the sweetest girl, but just absolutely in the bubble.
I mean, do you get the Grandpa Ken, I'll pray for you, Jesus loves you from them, or?
She's never mentioned it. I don't even know if she knows I'm an atheist.
Wow.
And I struggle with, okay, as she gets a little older, how do I get her thinking without having her go home and say, Grandpa Ken says Jesus may not have existed.
Well, it's a weird boundary issue, right? I mean, you're not her parent, but you are family. And, you know, you are living a loud, proud, secular life in full view, which I think, honestly, is probably the most we can do, right, Ken? I mean, we can just be who we are, be the skeptics and critics and happy people we are, superstition-free, and let everybody see us do it. And hopefully they'll come to the point in their own lives at some point. They'll come to us and say, hey, I've got some questions. I'd like to know more. I've had some doubts. Can you help me? And we'll be right there, ready and willing and waiting, you know?
And if you shock them by showing them that an atheist can actually be funny and a good person and kind, and that's, I think, a good way to go.
Dr. Valerie Tirico calls that messing with their categories, right? They put you in a box. But, you know, if you're living a wonderful life, a happy life, a fulfilled, joyous life, a life with your own sort of self-generated purpose, if you break all those molds, you don't fit in the box, you've totally messed with their categories. And that's a good place to be, I think. That's a good place to start. Ken, I appreciate you so much. Thanks for sharing your story. I do wish you all the best with your family. And we'll just hope for good things for you and your grandkids moving forward, okay?
Thank you, Seth.
Here's a message from Ben. He said, recently, my wife and I came out to our family as being atheists. At first, it was met with the usual, hey, if that's what you believe, whatever works for you. We started to notice that our families are treating us differently. My wife's grandmother posted on Facebook about how she grew up saying the Pledge of Allegiance with one nation under God added. So my wife, atheism aside, pointed out that she was mistaken because that part wasn't added until 1954. In the most respectful way possible, she stated the facts of the situation, nothing more. Her grandmother almost immediately erased her comment, and when my wife asked why she deleted it, there was never an answer. For me, my dad has since stopped talking to me about really anything having to do with my life. Our whole family's pretty much stopped with any interest at all, which makes us both very sad. Both sides are very religious and believe we will not be with them in heaven and that we are the ones causing their sadness. They seem to be fearful of opposing ideas, even in a calm discussion context, and always feel like we're trying to change them when we're just defending our place as atheists and the facts. Thanks for reading and all you do. You've been a tremendous help to us in both the process, and we consider you a part of our family now, Ben and Ashley. Hey, I'm hugging you both, okay? I'd like to think of this community in many ways as a family. I've said this before. But I'm guilty of compensating for what I feel I lack in family with father and mother and whatnot. I mean, it's not like we don't get along. We're just disconnected. My dad and I really are strangers. We were at a lunch a few months ago. We happened to be sitting across from each other at the table at my mom's birthday lunch. And I've known the man my whole life. He's my father. But I was just struck by the fact that we're strangers, just strangers. And so, you know, I can come here and I can go out to, you know, I can go to Wichita in March and I can go to Canada and I can go out to these events and I can connect with the people who don't think I'm out of my mind or an embarrassment or shameful or all those things. And I feel that sense of family. And I think that has merit. Often the family, of course, being the family you choose. But there are people out there who do have your back and through agreement and disagreement will respect you and love you for who you are. And I wish that for both of you, Ben and Ashley, and thank you. Cindy said on Facebook, she said this, "The divide with her family is interestingly not with religion, but with politics. The blue state, red state divide has had more effect on my family relationships and dynamics than religion ever did." Isn't that the truth? Amazing how polarizing this election season has been, the election itself, the Trump presidency so far. It hasn't died down. It seems to be only getting more and more intense. And it's amazing how much you learn about people when you see who their heroes are. Rebecca said, "Not to debate, but all love is conditional. I think unconditional love, even if it was real, would be a bad thing. Perhaps it comes down to the definition of love in that context." James said, "Luckily, my family still loves me a ton. And while it was hard at first, it's gotten better. With that said, I've known more than one person kicked out of their parents' home because they weren't a Democrat. So I thought I'd shed some light on this increasing notion that religion is so horrible, etc. Moral superiority is horrible. And that can poison the religious and not religious alike." Mauricio said this, "At family functions, in front of invited strangers, my family, ask for me to lead the family in prayer, knowing I'm a non-believer. They stand there with silent tears of laughter welling up in their eyes." Mauricio, I hope it's okay with you when I say out loud that your family can piss right off. What kind of shaming is that? What kind of sport is your embarrassment for their pleasure? What kind of family does that to people? I wonder how our other listeners would act or react in that situation. All right, your family knows you're an unbeliever and they ask you to say the blessing. How would you respond? Do you look at them and say, "Look, you know I don't believe. It's inappropriate to ask me." Would you just walk? Would you say a prayer that was hugely sacrilegious just to watch the look on their faces? Turn the table on them. Do you say a prayer to Satan or something? How would you respond if your religious family set you up and said, "Okay, Bob or Sue or Cindy or Richard, we know you're an atheist. Please bless the meal." What would you do? I think personally, I'd probably just look them straight in the eye and say, "Look, I don't believe in the God you want me to pray to. It's inappropriate for you to ask me here. I didn't come here so that you could try to diminish me to make yourself look bigger. I came here to spend time with my family because I love my family. But if you care more about your agenda than you care about me and just hanging with me and spending time with me and supporting me and building me up and at least respecting me throughout our disagreements, then the next birthday or anniversary or holiday or family festivity that you have that I feel I might be set up for, you will spend without me. Life is way too short." I have a feeling I'd probably say something like that. It feels good anyway to say it here. Let's go back to the switchboard. I've got Lexi on Skype. Lexi, you're on the Thinking Atheist Radio podcast. How's it going?
It's going good. How are you?
I'm well. We're talking about religious families, conditional love. What's your story?
Well, I'm actually very new at the whole atheist thing. About 7 or 8 months ago, I actually asked my boyfriend, who is a hardcore atheist for about 3 years now, what he looked at to kind of convert him from Christianity to atheism. He showed me everything that he looked at and read and watched. So I started doing the same thing, and I actually followed your fan page on Facebook, and my dad saw it. my dad sent me a text message. He hadn't called me in months or texted me in months. And he texted me out of nowhere and said, I see that you saw or that you started following an atheist page on Facebook. Are you an atheist now? You know, I didn't know how to answer that because I didn't want to label myself something that I wasn't. So I just texted him back. All I could say was, I don't want this to change our relationship. And of course, the normal, how dare you after all God has done for you and stuff like that. And so I didn't text him back and I asked my boyfriend what I should say because I didn't know what to say to this because he's the one who's dealt with it. I've never dealt with this, obviously. I tried to keep it quiet. And before I could even say anything back to him, he texted me and said, I would tell you that I love you no matter what, but something like this, I'm going to have to think about it and come back to you. Like it was, you know, a missed call or something. And so I haven't heard from him since then. And that was about 7 or 8 months ago. So I think I know what his answer was.
Well, tell me about him. I mean, was he fire and brimstone growing up? Did you do Sunday church with him?
Yeah. Well, growing up, his dad actually never went to church. He never really was a believer, but in my dad's 20s, maybe about my age, 21, his dad started going to church and he started going to church with him. When my mom and dad were married, they were actually youth pastors together at a church here in Georgia. And ever since then, he's just been, everyone but me is going to hell, it seems like.
My next thought is they're going to blame the boyfriend. They haven't already, right?
Mom has not. My mom has not blamed him. My dad doesn't know.
He doesn't know he's an atheist, or he doesn't know he exists?
He doesn't know that he's an atheist. He does know he exists, okay. But...
Right. He doesn't listen to the show, right? I mean, we're not outing anybody, am I?
No.
All right. You know, it's hard to know what to say in those moments, Lexi. It's so difficult to see parents seem to be more interested in an invisible father than a flesh and blood child. Certainly you feel that in your own heart, don't you?
Definitely. Yeah. It's always kind of been that way because the only way that we really had a relationship was through church. You know, he would get more involved. He would interact with me more in church and doing church activities than he would at home or outside of the church.
So you couldn't just hang out in the living room or go to the movies or go have dinner. It's usually a church function that provides the framework for your interactions.
Yeah, because the few times that we have had dinner together, because we've never lived with him because my mom and dad are divorced. But a couple years ago, I actually took him to Father's Day dinner. And it turned into a sermon because I hadn't seen him in so long. So I guess he had all that built up.
When did you first sort of call yourself an atheist? It hasn't been that long, you said. What are we talking about? Years, months?
Months.
Okay.
Probably not even there yet. I just don't know any other word.
Your world has changed dramatically. And
yes.
And how you doing? I mean, it's... Talk about a sea change at this point in your life.
Yeah. Honestly, it's still kind of scary.
What are you scared of?
Everything. It's a lot of emotions. It's scary. It's angry. I'm sad and I feel kind of betrayed. It's just a lot of emotions going on.
Does it make you resent your dad even more? I mean, do you feel bitterness and does it kind of tighten you up and you think, you know, how could he?
Yeah. Because, I mean, all through our childhood, you know, I don't want to make it like a sob story or anything, but he was never there, basically. Mm. So then to throw this at me like he knows what's happened in my life.
Do you have any siblings? Anybody else in the family who cares? Or?
I have a sister.
And her position on God is what?
She's kind of the same place. She doesn't pursue either side. Like I am.
Doesn't make any difference to her either way, huh?
Yeah.
Let me ask this question, and you don't have to answer it. But, you know, if your dad had been listening, there was a thought you wanted to communicate to him. You know, if I was able to sit him in a chair and say, hey, listen for just a second, Lexi has something to say. Is there something you would want to communicate to your dad? I mean, what would you say to the man?
Well, I have a lot of things that I want to say that I won't say here. But if I did have one major thing to say to him is I will always love him and I miss him and I wish that he would open his mind. I wish he would open his eyes and see that he's not the most righteous man on earth. He's not the best man on earth, and to answer for what he's done, and well, not answer for what he's done, but, you know, apologize, realize what he's done, and make amends with the people that he's left behind for something like religion.
And if I could sit him down, I'd say, you have a beautiful daughter who loves you, and you've wasted so much time. Don't waste any more. You know, go make it right and see her for who she is, not for who you decided a long time ago you thought she should be. Who she is so much better. Lexi, I'm glad to hear that you've at least found your voice. And ultimately, I don't know where the journey's going to take you. I tell people all the time, I didn't wake up one day and say, you know, today I'd like to reject everything that I once believed with all my heart. You don't choose this. You didn't choose this, did you, Lexi?
Oh, no. No.
Yeah, you started asking questions and you just finally admitted out loud what your own brain was telling you. Hey, wait a minute. Some of this stuff does not make sense. So whatever you call yourself, atheist, agnostic, you're on a journey. I mean, find the framework that works for you, but just make sure that it's done on your terms. And I think that's all we can ask of anyone. What's your boyfriend's name?
Brian.
Brian. Appreciate you, my friend. I don't know if he's listening or not, but Brian, thank you.
Oh, he's fangirling right now.
He's fangirling. Yeah, well, yes. Whatever. So he's a listener?
Yeah, we both are.
Well, you know, it sounds to me like he encouraged you to sort of take the journey, right? He sort of prompted you, hey, check this out. I mean, you were curious, but he sort of reinforced that for you. Am I reading too much into it? Am I trying to be too romantic about it?
Well, actually, I was kind of pissed at him at first.
You were pissed off because why? Because he was being so atheistic or what?
Yeah, he was just so atheist. It was just awful.
Brian, no, you're so atheist, for Pete's sake. And then what? Did you say, finally, I'm going to get to the bottom of this? And you began reading the stuff he reads and watching the stuff he watches. What happened?
Well, I was mad because he was right. And so, well, that's what it ended up being. But
he was right, by the way. Brian, you should make that your ringtone. Just play all the time. Just all the time. Hey, Brian was right.
Can you send me that? I want to be sure that we have that.
Just save that audio and use it all the time. Lexi, I'm sorry about your dad, but you've still got family and you got people out there who relate to you and who have your back. And I wish you a wonderful, happy life with Brian, and I appreciate you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Melissa had said on Facebook, she said, the problem she faces with religious family is the constant, mostly unspoken, but still very obvious and present belief that any big life difficulties I might be having, including my years-long struggle against depression, is directly linked to my having walked away from the Lord, and the expectation that someday, when I'm tired enough of struggling, I'll quit being rebellious and become a good little church girl again. My ability to have an honest, open conversation with religious family who I love and whose advice and opinions I, for the most part, respect, is severely limited when the topic is anything that I'm having trouble with. Often the areas in which I need the most help are the exact ones that are the most tainted by their beliefs, and it hurts to know I can't turn to them in times of need without just turn to Jesus being what they want to tell me. April said, my most religious relatives are also the ones most likely to be victims of other scams and fall for the most outrageous internet hoaxes. You know, I've noticed this too. I have noticed this too. You know, I had a relative, not a close relative. They were kind of a further branch on the family tree. They sort of dived into the social media ocean finally a few years ago. And you could tell they were new to the culture because they posted every conspiracy meme that you can imagine. I mean, the stuff you and I thought would be old hat, they thought was brand new and compelling information that must be shared. mean, it wasn't quite Bill Gates wants to send you $1,000 if you forward this email kind of thing, but it was along those lines. I mean, it was that obvious. And they're deeply religious people. And they were posting stuff about, you know, the 9/11 conspiracy stuff where the devil's face is seen in the fireball and all these obviously photoshopped things that are proof of God's return and miracles. Just, I mean, obvious stuff. Well, I, being so naive as to think that if they realized that the article or link they were posting had been debunked, they would want to know that, I went into the comments section in the thread and said, you might want to double check this. Here are some sources that have addressed these claims and debunked them. And here's the facts and here's the proof. Here's the evidence. Right? In my naive mind, I thought, well, certainly if they realized this was a bogus story, they would be eager to know and correct the record. And how wrong was I? I got a message from one of their relatives that said, stop correcting them. You're embarrassing them. You're making them look bad. Now, granted, I should have probably personally messaged them and said, hey, you might want to check this and remove the post or fix it, or, you know, you may want to know about this. A personal message probably would have been a better idea. I admit that. But I was so naive as to think that if they had posted publicly and there were hundreds of people who had seen the post, that those same hundreds of people would need to see the refutation. Of course, it's much more complicated than that when it comes to relationships, because they felt completely called out and shamed publicly. I had told them that they were wrong, you know, those types of things. So I totally understand, April, what you mean about these religious hoaxes, these internet hoaxes, political hoaxes, all kinds of hoaxes out there that many religious people seem to fall for. And perhaps that speaks to their intense desire to believe. Everything has a deeper meaning. Everything's part of a divine plan. Everything's a battle between the forces of good and evil, and nature itself is manifesting examples of that. Jeff on Facebook said he was tired of the passive-aggressive posts on social media. Someone mentions the lost, angry, bitter one in the family. And then when you speak up for yourself, you're lashing out. Jeff said he deleted every single family member off of Facebook because he refused to censor himself. You know, I'm fascinated by the responses and the first reactions of people when their children come out to them or their spouses come out and say, I don't believe. There's a video, it's been out for several years now, about a kid named Michael, young teenager. Looks like he might be, I don't know, 14 or whatnot. It's hard to see him in the video, but there's a camera, someone else holding a camera in the room, as he tells his mother and father that he is an atheist. Now, this is the audio of that video, all right? His mom's reaction when he tells her he no longer believes. Check this out.
You're an atheist. Give me a fucking break, Michael. All right, you know what? We need to start going to church every week. I've had it with this.
I don't believe in God.
Bullshit. You got yourself confirmed, and you said to the bishop.
Yeah, but a lot can happen. You can think.
Well, a lot can happen. All of a sudden, you can just quit believing in God?
Yeah.
All of a sudden, there is no God?
Yeah.
Well, let me tell you. You want to know there's no God? Then you're going to get absolutely nothing. Nothing for Christmas, because that's what Christmas is about, is Jesus Christ.
Okay.
No, it's not okay, Michael. It is not okay.
Hey, Michael. It is okay. It's okay. You hear that, and you just, the hair stands up on the back of your neck when you realize that this is the beginning of this conversation. This is the beginning of Michael's journey, because every hour of every day until he gets out of the house becomes a tug of war between his right to know his own mind and to pursue the evidence and to decide for himself what he thinks, and the attitude of his mother that she wants him to be an echo of herself, religiously anyway. Every morning when he gets up, every day when he's at school, every day at the dinner table, every weekend, every time he goes out, every time he chooses a friend, every time he takes a phone call, every time he talks to somebody on the internet or reads a blog or whatever he's doing, you know he's under the microscope. They're going to be watching him like a hawk, because you know those secular people are out there. these agents of Beelzebub. And I would honestly love to know how this kid's story's turned out or is turning out. Is he still there? Have they come to a moment of understanding? Did mom calm down? Did he move out? Are they existing in the same place, but they are strangers? I just found the audio of that exchange extremely compelling. It just draws a circle around the difficulties that some people face when they come out to the people they care about and to the people who matter to them. That they want to be honest. They're desperate to speak honestly. They're just saying honestly what they think and feel and where they're at in their own journey, and they are punished. I've got an email coming up in just a second from a woman who was raised in a family of Christian Scientists, and according to her letter, no one in their family ever told anyone else in the family they loved them. Never. And I'm going to talk to Patricia Guzikowski. She's a licensed counselor who is associated with the Secular Therapy Project, and she has done a lot of counseling of people who've gone through these types of situations. She's going to weigh in. That and more coming up next. Postage rates went up again, and Stamps.com is still the postage solution that saves you time and energy and travel and the wasted money on postage guesswork. When you sign up, Stamps.com even sends you a digital scale. It's really cool. It just plugs right into your USB jack. Your software sees it and calculates the exact weight for postage. And Stamps.com even helps you decide which mail class is the best for what you need. Stamps.com gives you discounts the post office does not, like 3 cents off every first-class stamp. Buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter, any package, any mail class, using your own computer and your own printer. Anything you can do at the post office, you can now do at your own desk, and it's awesome. Right now, use my code, Seth Andrews, for this special offer, a 4-week trial, including postage and a digital scale. Don't wait. Go to stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Seth Andrews. That's stamps.com. Enter Seth Andrews and sign up today. With stamps.com, you'll never have to go to the post office again. Today's show is called Religious Families, Conditional Love. I had a message in from Laura who said this. She said, I'm 47, and I've never heard anyone in my family say, I love you. I was raised in a Christian Science family that was always preaching God is love, yet ironically, we never expressed love towards one another. I can't remember a single instance of either my parents hugging me or my sister, or even each other. We were raised in a bubble of overprotection and isolation under my father's authoritarian rule. I spent an entire childhood and a good portion of my adulthood seeking approval from my parents and knowing that they would withhold their affection for any small infraction on my part. Christian Scientists, as they call themselves, are a rigid, nonsensical offshoot of traditional Christianity. They believe that illness is caused by a lack of faith, and therefore, if you are sick, you need to pray harder. You've probably seen members of the church in the news for allowing a sick child to die because they refuse to seek medical care. They are anti-vaccine as well. I had the pleasure of contracting measles, mumps, rubella, and chickenpox as a kid, and remember, no medicines. My parents would allow throat lozenges, but that was it. When I was in fourth grade and needed glasses, we prayed about it for a year until my parents took me to get my eyes examined. For a year, I couldn't see the chalkboard at school thanks to my parents' stupid religious beliefs. All the while, my mother was wearing contact lenses. Critical thinking was not exercised in my home growing up. My dad's favorite saying was, you can have whatever opinion you want as long as it's the same as mine. I think he pretty much stopped loving me when I got old enough to challenge his opinions. Then I grew up and married a man they didn't like, and the next 20 years were spent in this constant, silent battle in which they'd withhold their approval of me for any tiny thing they took as an insult or slight. They would stop talking to me for months at a time, and then start again and act as if I was the one who initiated the break. 10 years ago, I decided I'd had enough of their conditional love games and broke off contact with them. I wrote them a letter explaining my decision, which they ignored. I received a birthday card in which my mother wrote, "We still love you." That would be the closest either of them ever came to saying they loved me, and of course it was just part of their game. A few years later, after no contact on either side, my dad emailed to tell me he had been diagnosed with prostate cancer. We exchanged 2 emails, and that was the last I heard until last February when my cousin called to tell me my father had died. My mother didn't tell me. I had to hear it third hand from my cousin. I can only surmise that they felt insulted yet again because I didn't drop everything to run off to visit them thousands of miles away when my dad told me he had cancer. That's the worst part about this conditional love game. The rules are never revealed, and they change all the time. I've spent most of my life feeling like I did something to fail my parents and thinking that I must have done something to earn this treatment. Having raised 2 kids of my own now, I can't understand how a parent could be so cold toward their own child. My husband pointed out to me just the other day that my parents didn't seem to dislike me. They did a lot of really nice things for me over the years, but then they just as quickly pull the rug out from under me and reject me. I've given up trying to make sense of it anymore. The end result of growing up with conditional love is a profound sense of uncertainty. It affected my marriage in the sense that I felt for many, many years that I didn't deserve to be loved unconditionally, and I doubted my husband's love for me. To say I've put this good man through the ringer during our 25 years together would be an understatement. I've been so lucky to have found someone who is rational and intelligent and who's been able to help me come to terms with my upbringing. The fascinating part to all of this comes now that my children are grown. I see in them so much confidence as they make their way in the world, and I know that's largely in part to being raised with unconditional love. It makes such an enormous difference in the way they experience the world. A part of me is jealous that I didn't get that opportunity at their age. My life would have been very different. But overwhelmingly, I'm glad I was able to give them that gift that my family couldn't give me. Laura, thank you very much for sharing your story. And I'm glad your kids have you. I think that's an amazing thing. I've got Brian on the line. Brian, thanks for being a part of the show today.
Hey, Seth. Thanks for having me.
Well, we're talking about the consequences people pay when they are non-believers in religious families. Everybody's bringing their perspectives to the table. What's yours?
I grew up in a religious family. My family had been part of a Baptist church in my small town growing up. In fact, they were so involved that they eventually created a wing dedicated to my grandparents in the actual church itself. So it was sort of like a non-optional thing you had to be a part of. So as I grew up and grew out of that bubble and started doing my own things, I realized that that was not okay with most people. I think it was might have been kind of an embarrassment thing that I kind of moved away from religion in that way.
How did you tell them?
For a while, I just didn't go to church, and it became just something I didn't really talk about. Until somewhat recently, you know, past 5 or 6 years, I decided to become a lot more involved in atheist community locally, and then I kind of had to tell them, well, this is my perspective now, and that's sort of when the barrage of disappointment started rolling in.
Are you connected on social media with your family?
Sort of. I was connected with my sister for a while, but she really got tired of my perspective, so that she removed herself from that situation. It's hard because social media is not a good place to have relationships with people, you know, so you only hear little parts of their sounding board, you know. But for me, it was mostly the social interactions I would have with my family that were very awkward. Holidays were awkward, Christmas, very awkward. I would get birthday cards with, you know, 4 or 5 page letters inside explaining why I need to go back to church and get right with God and stuff like that. So it just became a barrier. So I couldn't really have the relationship I wanted to have with my family because it was sort of like you could do it only if that's the tragedy, I think, that religion puts in there. Because I, with my dad, who sent me that letter, and it was quite a long letter, I said, you know, I don't send you letters explaining why your religion is dumb or why you shouldn't believe this stuff. I don't care that much that you believe this. It's not a problem for me that you're a religious person, but it's a big problem if I'm not following there. Maybe it's a parenting thing. I'm not sure. It could be just personal.
My mother is big into Christmas cards, and I can always count on her at the end of every December, because whatever card she sends me is going to be just splattered in scriptures. You know, it's not just Merry Christmas, have a wonderful year, thanks so much, you know.
Right.
It's always the baby Jesus in the manger with the angels and a scripture that says Jesus came to earth to save all of humanity. I mean, it's so passive aggressive.
It's so true.
But it's nothing you can really call them on, right? Because they'll just be like, well, no, I just bought a Christmas card. And if you want to be self-conscious, and I mean, sounds to me like you've got a guilty conscience. I mean, it's totally a setup, right? So I never take the bait. But I mean, I can see you opening a birthday card and all of a sudden you've got four pages of somebody's religiosity just spilling out at you. It's so disheartening. Do you have a relationship with your folks today? Or
I do. It's really difficult. I mean, they don't live close by or anything. I mean, my mom does a little bit. I'll drive out to see her from occasion, but it's not something where I can go see him every day. The thing is, with my mother, she, in the past few years, decided that she wanted to become a Baptist minister. So she went through seminary and she did all this stuff to get her degree. And now she's very deep into, you know, analyzing scriptures and stuff like that. So me being the token atheist of the family, she's always throwing stuff over the wall. You know, did you ever read this? Did you ever hear about this? And I have to go, this argument again. And, you know, so it becomes like these constant explanations of my worldview, which I don't mind doing, but it seems to be, it gets a little old. Like, that's the only thing we talk about because she's so into it. For some reason, I just want to talk about the weather. You know, I just want to go and just have a good day with my mom, but it's never that easy.
Do you think she uses you in her sermons?
Probably. I don't want to know if she does, but probably. I'm on her mind quite a bit, I'm sure.
I'm talking next week with Bart Campolo. He's the son of famous American evangelist Tony Campolo. Bart is no longer a believer. But, you know, Bart was a minister with his dad for so long. And here you've got this famous evangelist who has ministered to presidents and spoken in front of huge arenas and whatnot. And now his son is essentially like, hey, Dad, I don't buy this anymore. And it becomes this weird thing. And they've managed to work through it. I'm going to talk to Bart next week about it. But it's weird. You know, it's hard. You're charged to carry the family mantle, right? You are going to be the next generation of us. And if you stray off that path, it just gets weird.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm glad you're having Bart on. That guy's great. I love Bart. And he and I have talked, and we have a lot of the same issues with having family in the ministry. And it's a hard conversation to have, because you don't want to, that's not where you are right now in your life as an atheist. It's like that. I don't think a lot about this. I've thought it through and I've kind of decided to move on with my life. And I want to build my own community around people that are similar to me and do good things. But I don't care really whether or not Jesus was a real person, or if they found some, you know, remnants of an old ancient city that was in the Bible. I don't care. No, and it's big,
oh, look,
it's big
more Dead Sea Scrolls, right?
Right. And so I get that article from the email. You know, here's an email. This is an article about, you know, one of my favorite ones was when my mother tells me that, you know, just off the cuff, she says, oh, isn't it amazing that the Grand Canyon was created by, you know, Noah's flood? That was where all the water went, drained out into the sea, was through the Grand Canyon. And those are the moments when I kind of take the bait, because it's a scientific claim. And I have to like run in there and go, you know what? That's actually not accurate. So I think she knows that I bite with those types of things. But for the most part, it's, you know, when she's talking about scripture and things like that, I just kind of go, yeah, whatever.
Despite the challenges in your own life, would you ever go back? No. Which pill do you take to go back into the matrix? You take the red pill or the, whichever pill that is, would you take it and go back into the womb? Or,
you know, sometimes I wonder, because there's a part of me that wants to have that relationship with my family, because it's in that DNA. Like, I want to be able to go to an event and really enjoy the family And, you know, back in the day when I was a religious person, I could do that. And I would just sing the hymns and do the thing, and it didn't make a difference. But now that I kind of have a different perspective, they treat me more like, poor you, you know, oh, you're, you know, it's sad to see that you've come to this. And it's like, I would like to tell them, no, I'm actually very happy. And I would love it if you could be happy for me too. So I don't know if it's a matter of, you know, re-brainwashing myself, but part of me thinks that it would be easier, but then I really actually enjoy coming to the table with a different perspective and saying, hey, here's how I feel about this, or here's what I know. And I'd love to have conversations about it.
Brian, thanks so much for sharing your perspective on the radio. I wish you all the best out there and all the best with your family as well. So thanks again, man.
Thanks, Seth.
Joining me for this last portion of the broadcast is Patricia Guzikowski. She is a licensed professional counselor, nationally certified. She's also a distance credentialed counselor. She runs the website freethoughtcounseling.com, and she's kind enough to join me here. Patricia, great to have you.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Patricia, I'm looking at your website, freethoughtcounseling.com, and you deal with, as you said, things like isolation, depression, anger, fear, grief, guilt, shame. Yeah. I'm doing a broadcast today about people who have in some way been sort of ostracized or cast off, if not physically, perhaps emotionally, right? Their families are devoutly religious, and they're paying a kind of emotional price for it. Have you seen examples of this in your work?
Yes. In fact, most of my clients have these issues. In the extreme cases, it's because they're a member of a cult or a religion that isolates them. For example, Jehovah's Witnesses. You know, they're not supposed to talk to anybody outside their religion. And even their family members, if they say that they want to leave the religion, their family members will shun them. So not only then after they leave their religious community, which has been what their entire lives were focused on, they lose all of their family members, and then they have no support, and they feel isolated. Or in some cases, I had a Mormon client, for example, who was still married, and she had met her husband in the church, and they had 4 children. And her entire family, her entire support system, they were still very devout Mormons, but she lost her faith. And she was told that she couldn't work outside the home, so she had been a stay-at-home mom and had no way to financially support herself or her children. And in her particular case, her husband's family members, they had several attorneys and things like that. So she was very afraid of how she could get out of that situation and still have contact with her children. So she was trapped in this situation, and she needed emotional support from me because she couldn't get it from anywhere else.
This is kind of a tough one. I'm not sure exactly how to phrase it. Let me just throw it out and we'll see where it takes us, okay? Is there a time from your perspective as a counselor when a family becomes so much of a negative force in your life that it's healthier to cut the cord, to say, no more, mom, dad, siblings, children, whatever? Does there come, in your opinion, does there come a point when you should say enough?
Yes, because it's critical to your mental health and your functioning. If you're in a situation where you're being abused emotionally or physically, or the anxiety, the depression, all the negative emotions that you're feeling in that situation are impacting your work or your ability to interact socially with other people, or just in general, your functioning. Some people become so depressed that like they can't get out of bed in the morning, or they can't take care of themselves, maybe not even take a shower because they just can't bring themselves to get up and do anything. And so in that case, if that's being caused by your situation with your family or your friends or your religious community, really the only way that you're going to be able to recover from that or improve your mental health is to get out from under that situation. Some situations are toxic. And especially if there's an abusive situation, it's better to figure out how to leave that situation. And not everyone can do that, or they can't do that very easily. They don't have the resources to do that. But eventually, hopefully, everyone can get out of that situation.
But it's my mother, and she's 75, and she's in poor health. And I know she treats me horribly, but she may not be with me next month or next year, and what if I lose her? I mean, a lousy relationship is better than no relationship at all. This is a rationalization that's happening. How would you approach that?
Okay, well, it's not always possible or practical for someone to immediately get out of a situation like that. Like you said, it's someone's mother, she's elderly, she needs care, they have an obligation, or they feel a very strong obligation. And in that situation, what we work on is just what you said, you know, the rationalization about how a bad relationship is better than no relationship at all, because that's not true. But it's something that we tell ourselves because we're afraid to be alone, or we're afraid of change, or whatever the reason, because change is really scary. And being alone for some people is not the way they want to live. It's frightening. It's isolating. But what has to happen is they have to be able to see that it would be better. They would be better off. Their lives would be better, the quality of their lives, before they can leave that situation. So if there are not any immediate safety concerns, then, you know, for their well-being in terms of, you know, their physical safety, or if they have a medical problem that's exacerbated by the stress of that, then it might be better for them to stay and meet this obligation that they feel until they have it worked out.
Now, obviously, this is kind of a worst-case scenario. It's not like I would want anyone to cut the cord. It's not like we're saying, you know, screw them all.
You know, right, right.
Don't attempt to. We're not saying that if your family's giving you grief and it's difficult and it's problematic, that the solution is to cut yourself off. That's not really what we want, right? If possible.
Right, right, exactly. It's just a matter of what can be worked out. You know, if you can work within that situation and it's bearable and you can experience things that are positive about it, but not have that life-crippling abuse or whatever the case may be, then that may be the best option.
Well, you know, Patricia, for me, it wasn't life-crippling. I've got devoutly religious fundamentalist parents, so we went through a couple of years where we really didn't speak, and it became really about boundaries. There's an interesting thing that happens, especially, I think, with parents in regard to their children. They feel that because they are parents, no matter how old the children are or where they are in their lives, there seems to be this ownership of who the children are and what they do. Like, this is how we raised you. This is what we intended for you. Mom and dad are still in some ways treating their older children like they have inherited the family mantle and are obligated to carry it forward. I don't know. Is that an accurate way to put that? Do you see that quite a bit?
Well, there are really two things that I see, mainly two things. And one is the parents are actually genuinely concerned, like, for the person, their child's soul. Like, I don't want my child to burn in hell for all eternity. And so thinking about it from the parent's perspective, you can see why if they really believe that their child was going to burn in hell for all eternity, then they would do whatever they could to try to get that child to believe again, or to be faithful, go to church, follow God's will, whatever, however they wanted to look at it. But then another thing is with parents, how their children behave, they take that as a reflection of themselves. So if your child's doing something that, you know, you feel is inappropriate or immoral, then you see it as, well, where did I go wrong? Where did I fail as a parent? And so parents don't want to accept that. You know, there are situations, for example, where the parents' religious beliefs tell them that being gay is a sin and you're going to go to hell. So then they think, well, my child is gay. I must have done something to raise them the wrong way, or they're in some way flawed. And even if it has nothing to do with the way I raised them, then maybe it's my genetics. And so they can't handle that for those reasons.
You know, my dad won't even come over for dinner. And I honestly think it's because I think that he feels that if we become too tight, if we're too buddy-buddy, if he enjoys my company too much, it becomes this endorsement of what he calls my atheist lifestyle, right? Well, if I accept him too much, then my tough love isn't in place and I'm kind of acting like everything's okay when it's really not. And it becomes hard because, you know, when you want to develop relationships with people that you do care about and you have this chasm, this sort of ideological chasm between you, it becomes a scenario where people say, agree with me so we can be friends. And that's very hard.
Yeah, and I think it goes deeper than that in some cases, too. It's not just agree with me so that we can all get along and have no conflict. It's also agree with me because if you don't agree with me, I might start listening to you. And if I start listening to you and if what you're saying is making sense, you might change my mind and I don't want my mind to be changed.
What would you call emotional abuse? You brought the term up earlier. I mean, if someone is dealing with a family member, a friend, someone in their inner circle, and, you know, they just feel beat up, what are we talking about?
Well, so, for example, public shaming. You know, you're sitting around with family at the Christmas gathering, and then your family member or members are looking at you going, well, I don't even know why you're here for Christmas, because you don't believe in God. You're immoral. You don't believe in anything. And it's done publicly, or even if it's not done publicly, but it's done repeatedly, things that are done for the purposes of making someone feel bad or telling them that they're inherently flawed because they don't believe or because they happen to be gay or lesbian or, you know, bisexual or transgender or whatever, doesn't meet with what that family member or friend believes is the right way to be. So there are other things that are more subtle. You know, we've heard the term gaslighting, for example. So, you know, they may tell you that you're going to hell or that no one respects you or that, I don't know, something over and over again, that even if you haven't felt that way or you haven't perceived it that way, it's everything is your problem all the time. And it's not only your problem all the time, it's your problem because you're an atheist or you don't go to church or whatever the case may be. So it could be like outright calling people names or trying to make them feel bad or just subtler ways, like the passive-aggressive type of behavior as well.
Gaslighting. Can you flesh that out for me? I mean, I think I had read about a scenario where there was, I guess, an abusive husband who had lowered the lights in the house to a point where it was unnaturally dark, and yet he had convinced his partner that everything was fine to the point where she felt, because she could not see, it was her own problem. Is that even close?
Right. I think that comes from a movie, so that's where we get the term from. But it's being told all the time that what you think is going on is not actually going on, or that really there's no problem with this relationship. You're just sensitive. You're too sensitive. So if you tell your partner, this is what you're doing, and I'm observing this, and let's work on it, and your partner says, no, I'm not doing that. I'm not doing that. I don't know where you're getting that from. That's all in your head. So it's about making you feel like it's all on you. It's either in your head or it's because you're in some way, you're imagining it, you're weak, you're too sensitive. It's not really happening. It's all you. And that way the other person doesn't have to accept any responsibility for that. And they put you down, make you second guess yourself, make you insecure, and it gives them more control in the situation.
I'm interested in language. It's the difference between someone saying, I'm sorry I made you feel this way, and someone saying, I'm sorry you feel this way. It's like, I'm right. Sorry, on its surface, feels like an apology. It feels like deference and compassion, but it in many ways is used as a weapon. You know, I'm sorry you're not smart enough to figure this out. You know, exactly. But that's not really an apology at all, is it?
No, it's definitely not an apology, because you're still saying it's the other person's flaw. So yeah. I'm sorry you feel this way completely invalidates what the other person is feeling and tells them, well, this is your problem, not my problem. So I'm not sorry about what I did or what I said. I'm just telling you that I feel sorry for you because something is wrong with you.
I'm sorry you think this is okay. I'm sorry you yeah. haven't figured it out yet. I'm sorry you know, usually the word you is your first ticket.
Right.
It's the first inclination that you're on that road, you know?
Yes, exactly.
Now, you do distance counseling through your website, freethoughtcounseling.com. This is counseling by phone, is that right?
Yes, telephone and email, both.
Okay. And you were also involved with the Secular Therapy Project. We've talked about them on the radio from time to time. Can you flesh out secular therapy for me real fast?
Okay, secular therapy means that if you go to therapy, you can trust that your counselor isn't going to automatically inject religion or spirituality in the counseling. And your therapist isn't going to say, okay, well, you have these issues because you need to get right with God. Or we need to talk about how prayer can help you in your mindfulness exercises or something like that. So you know when you go there, they're going to be using therapy that's evidence-based and that they're not going to inject religious or spiritual element into it.
The website for that is seculartherapy.org. Do you think therapy would help some of the people who are ostracized from their families? I mean, many times there's a stigma, a therapist, right? But it seems to help quite a few people. I mean, you would recommend this for people who feel isolated, alone. They're going through those feelings of grief and sadness and stress and confusion, yes?
Yes, absolutely. Because not only will it help them if they can talk to someone who understands their experience and who validates their experience and what they're going through, but also someone who can give them resources and help with you know, help them learn how to cope with what's going on. And sometimes it's just a matter of they need someone to talk to because they have absolutely no one to talk to. And in other cases, they want resources or to talk about where they go from here, help them figure out what it is that they want to accomplish and how do they want to get to that point. And so that's not something that most of us can do on our own.
Patricia Guzikowski, you can go to freethoughtcounseling.com to see her website. For your time and your expertise, it is greatly appreciated. Also, it's nice to see some science-based counseling going on out there, you know, some woo-free counseling. It's refreshing and amazing. So thanks for your great work, Patricia.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
And that's the broadcast today. I'll be back here Tuesday of next week talking to Bart Campolo, former evangelist. Now he is a secular humanist chaplain. I'm going to talk to him about his deconversion and his famous evangelist father. That's coming up next week. 2 weeks from tonight, we're doing a secular State of the Union address. It's going to be a great month of February. I'll see you back here next time on the Thinking Atheist Radio Podcast.
Follow the Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. Watch dozens of original videos on the Thinking Atheist YouTube channel. And visit our website for resources, links, contact information, the editor's blog, and more. TheThinkingAtheist.com.